You know the day destroys the night, night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide, break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, yeah. We chased our pleasures here, dug our treasures there.
Insurgent Radio Network calling. No, it's not. It's White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance Radio calling. And it's the 21st of March 2015, Saturn's Day. The last show of the week. Tomorrow we spend the day reverencing the sun, the All-Father Sun. Okay, now we just made it past the spring equinox. We're headed on into spring now, I think. I looked outside today. It was pretty warm today. Hey, guess what? Our 641-715-3800 with a passcode of 56890 pound is getting a lot of activity lately. Getting a lot more activity because I'm changing it every 2 or 3 days now. I know I keep promising that. Had some gal call in and said, hey, everybody's all upset because they saw you on that German documentary hugging a Niger woman. You know, whenever they can dig up something weird that they can throw at old Terrible Tommy, they do. Did Hitler shake hands with Molotov and Chamberlain? Did Nixon shake hands with Mao Zedong? What did it mean? And it's just a thing you do. So anyhow, that was that Mo Negro, that mulatto broad from Germany. And so they wanted a picture. So I thought that would drive the other side more crazy. But the right wing is picking up on that and saying, that damn Tom Metzger, he must love those niggers. Look at that. He put his arm around that nigger. All my offended people kiss my ass. Do you think I'm running around with niggers? I had sexual designs on that mulatto woman. Come on, give me a break, you bastards. Same people that bitch about things like that are the ones that never support us, never send a dime to us. But they're lurking out there like alligators in the water, waiting for any little thing that could, you know, be used against you. And they run with it every time. And you wonder why I hate the right wing. And anyhow, I was just commenting on that. But go on up there and call that number, 641-715-3800. And then if you're not too lazy, put in 56890 pound, and you'll hear the message. And that should be loaded. We're getting a lot more traffic, but not enough. One of the messages that came in, a person I've known for a long time, I'm going to play it for you. It might be a little bit hard to understand because it's taken on Skype. But here we go.
Caller, it's very interesting. There was a concept put forward some years ago, and I can't recall it at the moment. But it was called pre-sapien raciation, which gave a really good in-depth argument for the fact that race took place before Homo sapiens became Homo sapiens, before we actually became human beings. It was before Cro-Magnon and all this. It was before we broke off on a different branch with apes and things of that nature. Because if you look at many of the families of apes, chimpanzees, it had been believed for a long time that, for instance, chimpanzees' skin got darker as they aged, and they've found out that that is not the case. There are actually different, if you will, races of, say, chimpanzees. There are chimpanzees that under their fur they have skin that's as pink or white, if you will, as we have, and there are others that have it as black as a congoid. So, you know, you might want to look into that too if you haven't already. As I said, it's called pre-sapien raciation. So, again, Tom, take care. Be safe.
Well, it might be interesting to look up, see what's happening there, because a lot of the stuff that would prove our point is buried. And if someone's got the guts to even write it or print it. So sometimes you got to dig around a little bit, but that sounded quite interesting. Raciation? Yeah. Well, when you talk about yourself, what markers of personal identity come first? If it's not God, family, and country in that order, well, there go your credentials for the Nashville stardom. The real order is family first. That's blood, 62%, followed by being an American, 52%. Religious faith falls sharply to third place, 38% of its mentioning at all, according to a survey released Thursday by the Barna Group. The California-based Christian Research Company found another 18% of those surveyed said faith had little to do with the idea of who they are, and nearly 20% scored it at zero influence. Things are looking up, boys. No surprise, the folks Barna qualifies as practicing Christians, Catholics, Protestants, and Mormons, who say they have attended church at least once in the last month, and or say religion is important to them, scored faith highly at a rate more than double the national average. Evangelicals led the way with strongest faith-first identities. And of course, these are the ones that are going to vote for Israel every time anything comes up. They're more loyal to Israel and the Jews than they are to their own people in this country. But they're not most Christians, not by a long shot. The survey also found that only 37% of self-identified Christians are practicing, while 64% are non-practicing, said Roxanne Stone, a vice president of the Barna Group and a designer and analyst of the study. The results were also skewed by age. Family first, millennials, 53%. Generation Xers, 61%. Baby boomers, 64%. Elders, 76%. Blood. Being an American, millennials, 34%. Generation Xers, 37%. And baby boomers, 66%. Elders, 80%. That's strange. Religious faith, millennials 28%, Generation Xers 34%, and baby boomers 45%, and elders 46%. I think we're getting somewhere here. Barna surveyed 1,000 U.S. adults conducted online from February 3rd to February 11th, 2015. The margin of error is plus or minus 3.1 percentage points. Stone observed Generation Xers and millennials have a reputation for wanting to be individualists, for wanting to break away from traditional cultural narratives and to resist being boxed in by what they perceive as limited expectation. Well, here's where you get into the problem of the race mixing and things like that. They want to try out new things. However, give it a generation. Maximum two generations. You're going to see some funny stuff happening. And don't worry about it. The white race is still going to be here. But these people that go out wandering in the swamp, racial swamp, are going to learn a lot of things the hard way, I'll tell you that. Stone observed Generation Xers and millennials have a reputation for wanting... Will young evangelicals shift as they age? There's no guarantee of that. Well, they're the most fanatical Christian Zionists, especially. Robert Jones, CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute, drawing on their 2014 American Values Survey research, said white evangelicals may be facing the decline that mainline Protestant denominations faced years ago. He looked at the ratio of seniors to people under age 30 in their survey and found there were three times as many young, unaffiliated, with no religious identity. That's good. As there are white evangelicals under 30. There was a time when the evangelicals crowed about mainline decline and blamed it on liberal theology. But if you look at the millennial market share among the evangelicals, is now exactly the same as the mainline, 10%. This may not bode well for churches. That's fine with me. That's fine with me. Well, a renegade traditionalist, Roman Catholic bishop down in Rio de Janeiro, who caused an uproar in the 2009 by denying the whole Holocaust, defied the Vatican again Thursday by consecrating a bishop without permission of the Pope Francis. Bishop Richard Williamson, 75, performed the consecration of Father Jean Michael Forer, 73, at the Santa Cruz Monastery in Nova Friburgo, Brazil. Brother J.O. Ribeiro of the monastery told Reuters in Rio de Janeiro, the consecration, which the Vatican considers illegitimate, was also confirmed in a statement issued in Switzerland by the Society of St. Pius X, a traditionalist group that expelled both of them in recent years. The Society of St. Pius X regrets sincerely that this spirit of opposition has led to an episcopal consecration, the SSPX statement said. The consecration was first reported by the traditionalist blog Rurat Siali. Let's see here. There's a little bit more to this. In 1988, the founder of the SSPX, late French Bishop Marcel Lefebvre, consecrated Williamson. You know, way back in the 60s, when I had converted to Catholicism and was practicing Catholicism with my family, I joined up with that breakaway French bishop, Marcel Lefebvre. And then eventually just left the church altogether and left religion altogether. Anyhow, and three other traditionalist bishops who rejected the modernizing forms of the 62-65 Second Vatican Council. All were excommunicated from the church because they did not have permission from Pope John Paul. Well, there you go. The Catholic Church is gradually beginning to disintegrate around the edges. Who knows what fanaticism will take its place? I've got it. Islam. Well, I see this French comedian, was found guilty on Wednesday of condoning terrorism by posting a joke on his Facebook account after January's Islamist attacks in Paris, but he escaped a possible jail sentence. Yeah, what was his name? Duodin or something like that? The Paris court sentenced Diodon Mabala to a suspended sentence of 2 months in the jail. He had risked up to 7 years in prison and a potential $100,000 or $106,000 fine for free speech. So much for free speech in France. Diodon, who has repeatedly been fined by the courts for hate speech, well, it depends on which way you look at it, wrote on Facebook just days after the attacks that he felt like Charlie Coulibaly. That was a play on the ubiquitous "I am Charlie" slogan of solidarity following the attack against the cartoonist at Charlie Hebdo Weekly, using the last name of one of the Paris attackers. Amédée Coulibaly killed a police woman a day after the Charlie Hebdo attack and four Jews in a raid on a kosher supermarket, trying to get some Mogan David wine, I guess. 2 days later, he died in a shootout with police at the shop. I bet the shop owners wish they'd have had a gun. The feeling of hostility towards the Jewish community is that Diodoni kept up in front of a public attracted by his charisma increases his responsibility, the court wrote. That's one of those courts that could decide anything means anything. Duodani, who was not in the court on Wednesday, has been found guilty 7 times for free speech or anti-Jew statements. While his shows have been banned in some cities as a threat to public order, his lawyer declined comment. The comedian, who insists he is not anti-Jew, is credited with inventing the Guanelli, a gesture critics have likened to an inverted Nazi salute. Duodoni posted his Facebook comment on the eve of a huge public march of solidarity in Paris, in which more than 3.7 million, many carrying "I am Charlie" signs, honored the journalists, policemen, and shoppers killed by the militant Islam government. Well, there you go. They got Mr. Duodani on. He's in trouble. He's going to end up doing prison time. You wait and see. Or maybe the Mossad will blow him away. Who knows? But that's okay. As Mr. Duodani would say, that's showbiz, man. Well, part of being an opinion writer on the internet in 2015 is hearing regularly from folks who think your opinions are garbage. It's no one's idea of fun, but it's part of the job you take on when you put your opinions in writing for everyone to see. It's fine, but after Monday's post about the documentary Going Clear, Scientology and the Prison Belief, the responses were deeply affected. I've heard from almost a dozen former members of Scientology whose lives were turned upside down when they left the church, probably penniless, and many more who were shocked to hear about the lengths Scientologists will go in order to punish those who question them. I remember working with David McAlden years ago on an expose of Scientology, even to the point of my friend in his single-engine airplane taking us over there, sort of a voluntary prison camp in San Jacinto, California, where they were building this large cult playground and taking aerial photography of what was going on. They were almost, I think they were all white, or the ones I saw on the ground were all white, and they were working their ass off as slaves to Scientology. And I also had the news about the Scientologists that were running the Institute for Hysterical Review under Willis Carto. Tom Marcellus ran it for quite some time, I interviewed him on my TV show, and you can find it among our TV shows on the internet. And he was using his spare time sucking other people that were involved in the Institute for Historical Review into the grasp of the Scientologists to drain them of their money. I knew one gal, and I think I've said something about this before, that they got several hundred dollars, maybe a few thousand dollars out of her, and she's trying to get it back, and we helped her get it back. She finally got it back. But that's the way cults work. Anyhow, this guy says, as I wrote in the piece on Monday, one of the central characteristics of a cult is its unwillingness to ask critical questions of itself. And if it won't ask those questions from within, it's not likely to take kindly to people asking those questions from the outside. It wasn't long before I got an email from a Scientologist named Dave Evans with the subject line, "Remarkable." That's sarcasm, in case you're wondering. So here, in three easy steps, is how to get threatened by a Scientologist. Let's see if that's on here. See a documentary about Scientology with your husband on a Friday night. Write about the documentary on your widely popular blog about faith and entertainment on Monday. That's number one. Respond to the email by telling your new friend that his overzealous defense of Scientology does more to prove that they are a cult than anything else I could ever do. And the third is, wait another 90 minutes for the final email telling you that we are going to look into you and all the places you write for. Who are we? What are they looking for? Where is Shelley Miscavige? Nobody knows anything except that threatening a low-level journalist who wrote about a documentary is only going to make you look foolish. But they can get pretty serious if you've seen any of these exposés on Scientology. It's interesting how long Willis Carto played games with the Scientologists. I never been able to understand its infatuation with hiring Scientologists and even having them run the Institute. You know, it's amazing how churches change their whole philosophy based on the pressure of the times. They all do it. Well, over a year ago, the LDS Church issued a gospel topic statement about race that should have laid to rest the folk doctrines. That's interesting. Folk doctrines about race that had once propped up its racist priesthood ban. Oh, you mean the one that said if the Indians would go straight and be nice, they'd at some point turn white? Yeah, I guess they had to look at them, though, with those goggles that they dug up early in the church founding. That statement put the blame for the ban on widespread ideas about racial inferiority, unquote, that characterized 19th century America, affirming that God is no respecter of persons of race. Well, tell God I'm no respecter of gods, who are phony in the first place. Unfortunately, the statement has not yet been incorporated into the church's curriculum. Ooh. And earlier racial views still prevail among some Latter-day white saints. Today, guest blogger and Relief Society president Brandeis Roberts calls on the church to stop hiding its gospel topic statement under the bushel and use it to take a bolder stand to rectify the racist sins of the past with the Mormon church. Well, you know why they're afraid and they're scared stiff. They're going to get a mass exodus out of the LDS if they start pushing this stuff too hard. Before joining the church in January 2008, this is a black gal. I'm not even going to read this. This is some black gal that's got herself into the LDS. And going to change it all, man. We're going to all love each other and have sex with each other and just, it's going to be wonderful. almost as good as heaven. In fact, we won't have to go to heaven. It's going to be so wonderful, race mixing and all that stuff. It's going to be heaven on earth. The heaven, the great things of heaven coming down to the earth at that big tabernacle up there in Salt Lake City. That's where it's going to start and sweep the nation and the world. Well, the warmongers at work. You've heard of that Victoria Nuland, haven't you? And Robert Kagan have a great mom and pop business going. From the State Department, she generates wars. And from the op-ed pages, he demands Congress buy more weapons. There's a payoff, too, as grateful military contractors kick in money to think tanks where the other Kagan work. The other Kagan's work. Robert Perry wrote that. There's a lot more here, but we don't have time today. Maybe we'll go on a little bit with this. Pretty interesting. Neoconservative, not to be confused with the old-fashioned conservatives of back in the 60s. Pundit Robert Kagan and his wife, Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland, run a remarkable family business. She has sparked hot war in the Ukraine and helped launch Cold War II in Russia, with Russia. And he steps in to demand Congress jack up military spending so Americans can meet these new security threats. This extraordinary husband and wife duo makes quite a two-punch for the military-industrial complex, an inside-outside team that creates the need for more military spending, applies political pressure to ensure higher appropriations, and watches as thankful weapons manufacturers lavish grants of like-minded hawkish Republic or Washington think tanks. Wow. Let's see here. Let's get the rest of this. This is pretty exciting. Not only does the broader community of neocons stand to benefit, but so do other members of the Kagan clan, including Robert's brother, Frederick, at the American Enterprise Institute, and his wife, Kimberly, who owns her own shop called the Institute for the Study of War. What a crew. The Borges of Washington. Robert Kagan, a senior fellow of the Brookings Institute, which doesn't disclose details on its funders, uses his prized perch on the Washington Post op-ed page on Friday to bait Republicrats into abandoning the sequester caps, limiting the Pentagon's budget, which he calculated to be about $523 billion. While your roads go to hell, your bridges fall down, and everything else goes to pieces. The military needs the goddamn money. Apparently not counting extra war spending, Kagan called on the GOP legislators to add at least $38 billion, and preferably more like $54 billion to $117 billion. The fact that advocates for more spending face a steep uphill battle to get even that lower number passed by a Republican-controlled Congress says a lot. I don't know about that. Republicans are the war hawks. About Republican hypocrisy. Republicans may be full-throated in denouncing President Barack Obama for weakening the nation's security, yet when it comes to paying for the foreign policy that all their tough rhetoric implies, too many of them are nowhere to be found. The editorial writers and columnists who have been beating up Obama and cheering the Republicans need to tell these Republicans and their readers that national security costs money, 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 shekels, and that letters and speeches are worse than meaningless without it. Quote, it will annoy the part of the Republican base that wants to see the government shrink, loves a sequester, and doesn't care what it does to defense. But leadership occasionally means telling people what they don't want to hear. Those who propose to lead the United States in the incoming years, Republicrats and Democrazies, need to show what kind of political courage they have. In other words, balls. Right now, when the crucial budget decisions are being made, unquote. So the way to show courage, in Kagan's view, is to ladle ever more billions into the military-industrial complex. thus putting money where the Republicrats' mouths are regarding the need to defend Ukraine. Oh, yeah, Ukraine, we got to defend Ukraine. We got to defend. Every place we defend, you know, falls to pieces. Do you notice that? Every place we just go in and do the coup de grace and resist a bad nuclear deal with Iran, who have no nukes, like the sign in front of my house says. Iran has zero nukes. Israel has probably over 200 nukes. I didn't have to say any more. The whole picture's right there. And people drive by the hundreds and see that sign. I'm doing my little bit. Yet, if it weren't for Nuland's efforts as Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, the Ukraine crisis might not exist. A neocon holdover who's advised President Dick Cheney, Nuland gained promotions from Undersecretary of the State Hillary Clinton and received backing, too, from current Secretary John Kerry, the ketchup man. Confirming her present job in September 2013, Nuland soon undertook the extraordinary effort to promote regime change in Ukraine. That's just like saying assassinate the government. She personally urged on business leaders and political activists to challenge elected President Viktor Yanukovych. She reminded corporate executives that the United States had invested $5 billion in their European aspirations, and she literally passed out cookies to the anti-government protesters in Kiev's Maidan Square. Working with other key neocons, including the National Endowment for Democracy, President Carl Gershwin, and Senator John McCain, the war hawk, Nuland made it clear that the United States would back a regime change against Yanukovych, which grew more likely as neo-Nazi and other right-wing militias poured into Kiev from western Ukraine. Don't pay much attention to that stuff, because that's all flim-flam. In early February 2014, Nuland discussed U.S. desired changes with the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt, himself a veteran of a regime change operation at the International Atomic Energy Agency, helping to install U.S. yes man Yukaya Amano as the director general in 2009. Nuland treated her proposed new lineup of Ukrainian officials as if she were trading baseball cards, casting aside some while valuing others. Quote, Yats is the guy, she said, of her favorite Arsenal Yahyuk. It's hard to pronounce his name. His Slavic name. Anyhow, I'm not going to read the whole thing because it's a good article, but it goes on and on. And we know what's going on. You know what's going on, don't you? Are you out there? Send me a sign. Let's close out the show with a little tribute to religion here. And my favorite website, JesusNeverExisted.com with Mr. Humphreys. Yeah, let's do a little bit of that and see what happens. See if I can offend any more people than I already have.
Difference between a history embroidered with propaganda, such as we find, for example, in Julius Caesar's Gallic Wars, and a fantasy placed into a historical setting. Such an example would be Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes. The Jesus Tale is very much in the latter category, a fictional drama in which a stereotypic hero has been intruded into a more or less realistic historical landscape. As we would expect from a fictional creation, there exists not a single contemporary reference to such a character, not a single genuine artifact, nothing to substantiate that he ever walked the earth. The traditional authorized version of Christian origins is a Big Bang theory. It suggests that one fine day the only begotten son of God materialized in a virgin's womb. He grew to manhood, assembled his disciples, imparted his wisdom, died, and rose again. From this a religion was born. How far should the rational thinker buy into this story? the idea of Jesus convinces many that someone must lie beneath the encrusted legends. Many, of course, reduce the Christian superstar to a dimly perceived good man, who perhaps said some wise words, fell foul of Roman and Jewish authorities, and managed to get himself crucified. The Big Bang Theory now boils down to little more than Christianity exists, it must have begun somewhere, it began with a single character, here's my version of who he really was. And favourites include an itinerant philosopher, or a religious reformer, a pacifist like Gandhi, or a militant like Che Guevara. In fact, Jesus has been reformed 100 times. One thing of which historians and New Testament scholars are well aware is the trajectory by which the Jesus Tao developed from an original text. Matthew, Luke, and even the fourth gospel build on a brief original Tao without miracles and post-death appearances, written at an uncertain date by an anonymous author. Church tradition alone identifies this as Mark. Matthew took the story off in one direction, and he packed the text with prophecy. Luke, in contrast, trawled through the works of Josephus for cool tidbits of historical accuracy. Whatever else, eyewitness testimonies they are not, and the story was all but unknown until the second half of the second century. Aware of these difficulties, New Testament scholars suggest a number of traditions preceded the Gospel tales. And what do these earlier traditions tell us of Jesus? The Essenes anticipated Christianity in a number of respects, as did the Therapeutes of Egypt, held by the church historian Eusebius as early Christian monks, yet they were established well before the Christian era. What then are we to make of the thinly drawn life of Jesus? It certainly appears to owe an extraordinary amount to Jewish scripture, whether drawn from Adam, Moses, Enoch, Melchizedek, Elijah, Elisha, etc. And it's a vast anticipation of the words and deeds of Jesus. Christian apologetics uses the words fulfillment, but a simple word copying explains the same. What are we to make of the multitude of parallels to Jesus' law to be found in ancient world mythology? Even the embarrassed church fathers spoke of diabolical mimicry. It seems that Satan himself clearly understood the true message of the Jewish prophets and was thus able to preempt Christianity centuries before the arrival of Jesus by copycat gods. In fact, we have absolutely no trace or mention of Jesus' exploits anywhere until the Gospels were written decades after the purported events. Desperate to penetrate this fog, some scholars strive to identify an early layer of teaching, said to derive from an historical Jesus. But does a sayings tradition really point to a single author of wise words? The Bible itself provides an answer. We have a sayings collection in the book of Proverbs, which is attributed to Solomon, but it was standard practice in the ancient world to lend authority and prestige to new material by falsely accrediting a prestigious figure from the past. But even more fatal to the claim of a sayings tradition is the patent failure of anyone to record any of the supposed astounding new teachings at the time. If a great multitude throughout Syria, Galilee, and the Judea heard and believed, how odd that no one recorded those sparkling gems of wisdom. The truth is that Christianity grew from neither a god nor a man, but out of what had gone before. A human Jesus was no more necessary than was a human Horus, Dionysus, Mithras, etc. Can we explain the emergence of Christianity without its superstar? Of course we can. For 2 centuries the Christian movement languished, and thanks to civil war it got its big chance. It was the ultimate product of ancient religious syncretism. But it isn't history, it isn't truth, it's more astounding rubbish from the New Testament. Yes. I'm very fond of their courtroom dramas, in which carefully chosen experts, under cross-examination, confirm the whole 9 yards of Christian doctrine. Of course, the experts happen to be Christians, but that's by the by. Well, I'm going to offer you a courtroom drama of my own today, and this time we are going to put Christianity on trial. So what are the charges? The first charge is that Christianity is an organized protection racket, which exploits popular fears and uncertainties for its own purposes. Christianity invents a bogus problem, that we are all sinners against God's laws, and then offers itself and its invented God-man Jesus as the only solution. By this means, Christianity draws into its clutches millions of gullible victims. The second charge is that Christianity is an organized criminal organization that has plundered the world's riches for 1500 years, accumulating vast wealth and income, and that in the pursuit of this goal, it has waged aggressive wars of conquest, enslaved whole nations, and along the way exterminated millions of innocent people who resisted its designs. The third charge is that Christianity has willfully obstructed human progress and condemned humanity to centuries of poverty, misery, and suffering. In particular, it has obstructed the advance of human knowledge and scientific understanding of the world, including, of course, science itself. A fourth charge is that Christianity has abused and victimized its captives on a monumental scale, its priests and henchmen acting at will and under the protection of the hierarchy of the church, a self-perpetuating and self-protecting empire of physical and sexual abuse. No defense can be mounted against crimes of such horrendous and universal nature. But pleas of mitigation can be made. Christians can claim it was not me. Christians can claim their doctrines give hope to the desperate and consolation to the lonely. But how much false and empty hope can justify wars of annihilation? How much touchy-feely comfort would it require to mitigate the centuries of tyranny and exploitation? The short answer is not nearly enough. Christianity is not only a deceit, a lie, and a scam. It is a crime against humanity, and it belongs in the garbage bin of history with the rest of the rubbish.
Let me begin with a card trick. The deck of cards is actually the Bible. There are a number of books in the Bible, and they purport to tell a story, a continuous tale, which spends an awful lot of time talking about the trials and tribulations of the Jews, before it gets on to the happy story of the New Testament. And it begins, of course, with the birth, and goes through a whole set of stories until we get the foretaste of things to come in the Revelation. Okay, now, what has been done there invites you to take that journey of faith that you see in the history of the Jews, the desire, the awakening, the awareness of a coming Messiah, and that's told, would seem, in a logical fashion. However, the part of the preloading of the deck of the Christians is to shuffle the Old Testament slightly. The Jewish scriptures are made up of the law, the prophets, and the writings. But in the Christian version of that book, you'll notice they're slightly rearranged. The law, the writings, the prophets. Now, why do they make that slight change? Well, because they have a purpose in mind for the prophets. They are going to foretell their coming Messiah. So it's brought forward in time slight. Wouldn't matter much, perhaps. Except that when we get on to the New Testament, the deck has been shuffled quite considerably. Shuffled in the sense, I mean, of its chronological development. The deck has been preloaded before the hand is dealt. If we put the books into the order in which they were written, we see a rather different picture. The one that it's put together is assembled for a purpose. But the purpose is clear if you rearrange them. Now, the first book of the New Testament, as you all know, is Matthew. And Matthew begins with its story of the genealogy of Jesus, and then the Nativity and so on. But in actual fact, the first book for Gospels in the New Testament is the Gospel of Mark. And Gospel of Mark precedes the others and is used by them. 95% of the words and phrases in the Gospel of Mark are to be found in the Gospel of Matthew. There's a huge copying process gone on there. Matthew doesn't stand as an independent observer of what went on. He has actually taken Mark's Gospel and copied nearly all of it. The same phraseology, the same words, the same sequence. 95% appears in Matthew, 65% appears in Luke. So Luke has done the same thing. And although the Gospel of John has traditionally been regarded as taking a separate course, even John borrows from the Gospel of Mark. So we can see how the sequence is different, and I'll explain in a moment why that is important. Even more of a radical shuffling of the deck is the fact that the earliest Christian testimonies are the epistles. They were all written before the Gospel. Well, if you look back over the span of the four Gospels and put them in the order in which they developed, you can see the whole trajectory by which the Jesus story develops. In Mark, Jesus enters the scene after a brief introduction of John the Baptist. Jesus goes to John the Baptist and is baptized. It's significant that that event occurs at all. After all, in the light of what we know about Jesus, that he was God on earth, why would he need a baptism? It's an embarrassment that the church has struggled with. A God doesn't need a baptism for the remission of sins. But of course, Jesus in the Gospel of Mark was not a God. He was a righteous man. He was a righteous man God had chosen. And that's why when he's baptized, the heavens open and the Spirit of the Lord, the Holy Spirit, descends upon Jesus like a dove. Now, again, that would be redundant if he had been born as a child and it was God incarnate. Why would he need that extra infusion of the Holy Spirit when he's baptized? Well, he didn't. So Jesus, in version one, as it were, is a righteous man chosen, a bit like other righteous men, like Abraham was chosen. A righteous man is chosen by God for the Holy Spirit. And if you see that story as the embryo of the whole development, you'll understand some of those anomalies you get. For example, what were Jesus' last words on the cross? Well, you probably know it's different in each gospel. In Mark, it's known as the cry of dereliction. My God, why have you abandoned me? Now, why on earth does he say that? Isn't he God? Well, no, he isn't in that stage. And the God that's abandoned him is the Holy Spirit. It leaves him. It goes back to heaven. The man, Jesus, dies. That's version one of the Jesus story. If you move on then to Matthew and Luke, you'll see why they change it. Because in Matthew and Luke, Jesus has become more than just a righteous man. He's become a demigod. He's man and God. And so they have a less dramatic, a less sorrowful sort of ending. Into your hands I commend my spirit. It's all for resignation. Move on to the Gospel of John, where Jesus has become a God. Great I am, from before time itself. I am this, I am that. What does he say at the end? It's finished. It's a God. He's done his thing. It's finished. There's no human pathos there. There's no downbeat mode. It's just a matter of fact that God has finished his purpose. So you can see in this migration through the Gospels, when they're in their correct order, how the notion of Jesus himself has been changed. He's been changed from a righteous man through a demigod to a God.
And Jesus, as a really nice man, offering kindly words of hope and reassurance to the poor, the desperate, and the lost. Isn't he the guy who preaches love of neighbour and of enemies, of going the extra mile, of forgiving 7 times 70? Surely these are the words of a great humanitarian, of a supreme moral teacher. Well, sorry, pal. This supposed paragon of moral virtue is an illusion. When you remove the cotton wool from your eyes, you will realize that the stylized character of Jesus the Lord is a rigid, intolerant authoritarian, spouting a venomous creed, simplistic and cruel. Let's begin with one of Jesus' most celebrated dictums, love of enemies. As it stands, that idea has always struck me as a most ridiculous precept. At best, it is an extravagant exaggeration of a simple enough principle. Treat your opponents with civility, your enemies with humanity. The Greek philosophers were certainly attuned to such notions of moral virtue when dealing with their adversaries, long before similar words were put onto the lips of Jesus. But what would love of enemies really mean? Let's be guided by Jesus' own behavior. How does Jesus himself deal with his own enemies? Throughout the Gospels, Jesus runs up against those notorious scribes and Pharisees who, quite reasonably, question his odd teachings and behavior. How does the Lord from heaven respond? With love? No, on the contrary, with curses and with threats of eternal damnation. The man famous for his condemnation of hypocrites is himself a hypocrite. Jesus makes abundantly clear that his love of enemies extends only to those enemies who have fallen at his feet in abject submission. He deigns to love them only because they humble themselves before his absolute lordship. He that believeth not shall be damned, says Mark. And just as Jesus' so-called love is indiscriminate, so too is his retribution towards those who don't immediately bend their knee. He threatens destruction and everlasting torment to entire cities for their reticence to immediately embrace him as their new Lord and Master. Or, as Matthew puts it, it will be more intolerable for them on the day of judgment than the land of Sodom and Gomorrah. What we have here are the brutal ethics of a pre-modern warlord, poised before a besieged city with his murderous horde. Immediately embrace me as your king, and my mercy will allow you to live on as a slave in my kingdom. Or else, every last one of you will die a horrible, lingering death. And this is a Jesus, a character presented to young children as a figure worthy of reverence and worship. But let's move from enemies to those nearest and dearest to us, family. Again, we see in the Jesus figure that same streak of simplistic intolerance, lacking any normal human compassion. According to Matthew, Jesus allows divorce, to a man that is, solely on the grounds of his wife's infidelity. According to Mark and Luke, not even is that option allowed. Any remarriage is an act of adultery. Now, this is a cruel, simplistic, and wrong ethic. If we were to follow these teachings, as the church in Europe did for centuries, married people would almost certainly face a life sentence of domestic violence, physical and psychological abuse, and sheer misery. Today, we recognize the limitations of marriage. We are enlightened. The words placed in the mouth of Jesus are the sentiments of a primitive, barbarous culture. Could we say that Jesus is the upholder of strong family values? He does, after all, preach the brutal doctrine that the person who speaks evil of his father and mother should surely die. But let's get real here. might not some children have perfectly good reasons for not honouring their parents? From end to end, the moral code of Jesus is crass, simplistic, and above all, irrelevant to the 21st century.
Judging from my mailbox, many believing Christians are very aware of the criminal history of the church. But they excuse themselves from all complicity. The perpetrators of individual cruelties, mass abuse and wars of genocide and conquest were, it seemed, not real Christians at all. Real Christians could do none of these things because Christ, we're told, taught a message of peace and love and humility, even poverty. If only the church had followed the message of Jesus, none of those centuries filled with bloodshed and suffering would have unfolded the way they did. So by a quick sidestep, today's Christians wash their hands of any and all crimes, misdeeds and follies of their forebears. But let's take a closer look at this, because it is mighty strange that for more than 15 centuries and across all the world's continents, self-styled Christians have willfully or unwittingly misunderstood the message of their Lord and robbed when they should have given, punished when they should have helped, and murdered when they should have loved. So why have Christians always got the message wrong? Could it be that the message is rather less straightforward than many of today's more humane Christians naively imagine? Christians, that is, civilized by science and secularism. But let's consider Jesus himself. Jesus preached an absolutist belief of good and evil, with no shades of grey. Whoever is not with me is against me, he says. Those who believe will not be damned, but unbelief arouses his anger, his impatience, and his utter abuse. In Luke 19:27, Jesus calls for the murder in front of him of all those who refuse to worship him. Jesus pours forth a stream of invective. He threatens insatiable revenge, outer darkness and an eternal punishment, explicitly stated at least 30 times. You love your neighbour as yourself, but only if he receives the good news. If not, shake off the dust from your feet, and it'll be more intolerable for them on the day of judgment than the land of Sodom and Gomorrah. Depart, says Jesus, into everlasting fire. Jesus calls his detractors serpents and a generation of vipers. He promises them a fire that is never quenched. In fact, his attitude is an assurance of everlasting torture. The Gospels are an immoral fraud, and Jesus is not Mr. Nice Guy at all, but an intolerant, vindictive, egotistical bully, just like the priests who invented him.
Well, is that enough blasphemy for you? But it's true. It's true. You know, that Bible's the most pornographic, genocidal book ever printed. They should keep it behind the counter in the bookstores so young kids can't get a hold of it. I wish I'd have known this information when I was young, instead of being forced into these mind control centers they call churches for most of my life. I'll see you Moon's Day. And remember, 14:5 and shut up.